You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Indeed, it is at 18 minutes after 11, and thank you so much for staying with us. Today, we're going to be talking about anxiety in children. And when you are raising a child that has a lot of anxiety, what do you do? Tell us what has worked for you as a mom, as a dad, as someone entrusted with children in your care. And if you are struggling with a child that has anxiety, then give us a call. And we're going to do our best with one of our regular experts in this slot, Stephanie Dawson-Cosser, to help you if we can between now and noon. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg and in Cape Town, 021-446 605-67. First time I'm seeing you this year. Happy Easter.
Thanks, Eusebius, and to you.
How are you, Stephanie?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's very good to see you. Obviously, anxiety is part of life. I cannot imagine a well-adjusted human being never experiencing anxiety. In fact, you probably would have to be a weirdo to never have any anxiety, right? So I would imagine that there is healthy anxiety in children or adults, and then there's anxiety that is not so healthy.
Exactly. So essentially, anxiety is there as an expression of stress, which sits around fear. It's triggered by fear. So essentially, obviously, if we are in danger, fear and anxiety is a good thing. It's going where our brain is going to be flooded with adrenaline to keep our heart pumping and cortisol to keep our ourselves alert. And we're going to make a decision. Do we need to run? Do we need to be stuck exactly where we are, or what are we going to do? So we talk about fight, flight, or freeze. And that's very appropriate when we are in a life and death situation. But the trouble is that we, you know, physically we may need to move to be in a safe place. Yeah. But exactly the same applies emotionally. So we all have an internal sensor that is telling us, are we safe here or are we not? And anxiety is triggered when we don't feel safe.
And I think that's an important starting point, because often experiences and emotions like anxiety are vilified in especially a lot of popular, I'm not so sure about academic literature on different kinds of emotions, as something that is intrinsically bad. And we're gonna talk about anxiety that can rob you of a decent quality of life as a little one, as and also the whole family can be affected by a child's anxiety. But I think this is a very good starting point, isn't it, to also recognize that there is a functional value that anxiety has. So we shouldn't get too anxious about anxiety too quickly.
Exactly. It's really an internal monitor that's guiding us to keep ourselves safe. So the point is, we need to learn how to navigate. So we need to learn how stress, how anxiety shows up in our system. And when we are small, we need an external person, usually our parent or parents, or a consistent caregiver, to take away that sense of anxiety. So in the infant stage of life, we tend to think that a crying baby is something we need the baby to shh. But in fact, the baby's language to communicate with us is through crying. There is a cry to say, I'm cold. There's a cry to say, I'm hungry. There's a cry to say, I'm uncomfortable with a puffy nappy. There's another cry that says, I'm in this space and I feel very alone. And all of those are slightly nuanced cries. And the parents, if they listen closely, they'll be able to tell the nuance within a few weeks, even in a few days. What is the difference? The trouble is, because we live in a verbal world as adults, we want the baby to say, I'm hungry now, give me the breast or the bottle. I'm uncomfortable now, please give me a clean nappy. But they can't do that. So we are always interpreting. And that's what pushes up the anxiety, even in those early hours and days of becoming a parent, because we're trying to learn this new language.
That is fascinating. Does that mean with babies and with toddlers, we possibly sometimes misdescribe situations as anxious, when in fact they are just really situations in which baby or toddler is trying to communicate information that they don't have sophisticated skills to communicate.
Absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head there. It's their way of saying something in my system, because they're really only aware of their system, their body, something's not okay. Mm. And crying is a way of saying to the outside world, help. And then it's a kind of, hunt the thimble kind of game for parents, because they've got to work out. Is it just to comfort, to say, you're not alone, I'm here? Is it to address something of a more physiological nature? Mm. And that's the exploration and the learning curve for the parent.
Easier said than done. If you are a parent, how have you dealt with this? Do you have a baby at the moment in the house that you carry around with you? And how do you respond to crying, for example, or other signs of distress that instinctively and intuitively you might take as an indicator that your baby is really, really, really anxious, as opposed to simply wanting to communicate with you? Does what Stephanie is saying resonate with you upon reflection? Or how hard is it nevertheless to respond instinctively as a mom, as a dad? 011-883-0702 in Joburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Now, the world is a scary place, and I would have thought that provided pregnant woman does not do anything to harm the baby while the baby is still in the tummy, mm-hmm. that one of your safest 9 months as a living organism before you are a full-fledged person is probably inside mom. And yet, what is so interesting, which I want you to unpack for me, is how some of the more unhealthy kinds of anxiety that babies and toddlers may come to exhibit once they are living outside mom's body is as a result of stress that mom could have passed on.
Mm. So, of course, baby is in utero, and the utero is part of the mom's physical system. And so when mom feels stress, her heart is going to race. She's going to have a limbic system response to physiological response to everything she's experiencing in her world. And so there is some of that that is translated across. So if mum is in a situation where she's in an abusive relationship and there is arguing and fighting going on, she's physically going to be more tense in that moment, in that interaction. When a mum is in a loving, nurturing relationship, and she's at ease with her partner, and coming home is a relaxing, nurturing space, she's physiologically going to be more relaxed as she gets, sure. as she arrives at home. So there's some matter of transfer of picking up the tension or picking up the relaxation. And we can't say it's definitely this or it's definitely that, but there's a measure of, there's a sense that when mum has been stressed, baby may be more stressed. When
that's quite scary, right?
It's very scary. But we, you know, because
it's amazing how much of your early life can be determined by behaviors not of your own choosing as a child.
And of course, then it triggers the never ending debate around nurture versus nature. And, you know, when we talk about anxious children, is it the environment or is that just their personality? And if we look at personality, there are some personalities that are more, what's the right word? They just feel, they sense the world much more acutely than others. Mm. And it's not necessarily the introvert versus extrovert debate, but we can have four children. Well, I have four children of my own, and we, you know, they all grew up in the same environment, have gone through the same experiences. We will sit and they can argue till the cows come home about four different perspectives. And so these are the nuances of parenting and caregiving, that we never know how much is nurture and how much is nature.
So how do I begin to, is this just something that happens instinctively? How do I begin to differentiate between what is healthy anxiety, where a baby, for example, or toddler, or even a you know, a child who's, I don't know, 8, 9 years old is simply being a child and trying to communicate with me that they're unwell. And a situation where I'm listening and I'm now in tune, as you put it earlier. How do I get that bit where I'm so in tune that I know this cry, it's not the normal cry of baby who wants to be breastfed. This is a different kind of cry. Is that something that parents just develop instinctively with their interaction with the baby?
Well,
or does it have to be taught? Can it be taught?
I think it's a bit of both.
Okay.
And because with technology, we keep on learning. There's a beautiful bit of research, which I hadn't double checked before I came here today, so I can't give you the researcher's name offhand, where she studied infant cries in the first 3 weeks of life across something like 15 different cultural groupings. And there are 5 identifiable cries that across all cultures. So it's not about the language they're hearing. It's an it's an innate way of communicating. I'm lonely. I'm hungry. I need comfort. I need food. And so it's just fascinating. So that's the scientific part. That that research is showing that infants will do, respond and try to give expression in very, very similar ways across whatever culture grouping they're from. How do we do it as parents? We can, the more time we spend with our infant, the more, I mean, that's why maternity leave, for example, is so critical, because it gives that bonding time. Because it is about time spent as opposed to reading out of a book.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so give us a call. We'll take a bit of a news break here. But I want to hear from you. How do you deal with anxiety in toddlers, in babies, in newborns? What lessons have you learned over the time to distinguish the different cries that you might get from them? And have you been able to deal with your own almost second order anxiety? In other words, your anxiety about the anxiety that a child might have, which I think must come naturally to at least most parents. Or are you struggling with that right now? 011-883-0702. If you need any advice from Stephanie Dawson-Kosse, or just share your experiences as a parent with us. And if you are in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Brenda, good morning to you, and thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, thank you, Eusebius, for taking my call, and thank you for your guest, as well as to the listeners. I just wanted to share my experience. My first child I had when I was 19, and I was very, very content and happy with my husband. And I had the most amazing baby. My second and third child, our relationship was very stormy, and they were totally different. I did exactly what I did with the first child, but you know what? They were anxious, and it was a hard road. And even today, you know, my son has passed away, but he was always an anxious child. And before listening to your program years ago, I thought about it. I thought, you know, your first pregnancy was so different. Your second and third was fraught with anxiety, which I believe then affected the unborn baby. So I would just encourage, really, really encourage any mom-to-be to ensure that she really, really looks after herself. And as much as what is possible, you remove yourself from unnecessary stress, because I am convinced with the second and third children, it had a major effect on their life.
Sure. Thank you, Brenda, for sharing that. What comes up for you, Stephanie?
Well, I think it's a beautiful iteration of what we were saying earlier, and to be mindful that, you know, we get so excited in the anticipation of becoming a parent that we forget that we need to look after ourselves. So in my coaching space, I'm frequently working with parents who have children of a variety of ages and stages of life, but essentially it's a parent sitting burned out, and they're burned out because they haven't been able to take care of self. They've been so focused on raising a child. And so it's
that is quite fascinating to me, I must say. I'm not a parent at all, so I'm fascinated more intellectually than experientially. The idea that because I can imagine why for many parents what you've just said would be very hard for them to practice, practice, because the idea that one of the best gifts I can give my anxious ones is to role model for them that I'm still my own person. I can get on with all sorts of things rather than making them the center of my universe.
Yeah.
When in fact, if a child is crying or irritable, I would imagine the instinctive response is to try and center them in your own world.
And so it's that push me, pull me that every parent experiences. And especially when we're multitasking, when we're invariably a working parent. So we're, you know, we've got responsibilities outside of the home. We've got responsibilities inside the home. And there are some hugely liberated dads who are really contributing within the home. But somehow that mother nurturing role is somehow an overarching role that mums often can't say, I need help.
Yeah. Lee, good morning.
Hi, Insidious. Interesting show. So I'm not a parent yet, but I've got a much younger sister, and she grew up very close to me. And we had a very helicopter mom, but in a very positive way. She was involved in, you know, all our lives and everything, but my sister was very introverted. And she skipped a couple of grades at school, so she was advanced, but very, very, very shy in front of people, but she could express herself very well at home. But now that she's graduated and actually gone into the workspace, her first week at work was terrible for her because she kept calling me. She's like, I'm just so anxious. I don't know how to express myself, you know? So I just wanted to know. And I mean, she's quite young. She started working. She's just 20. I just wanted to know, you know, going from home into a workplace, how can somebody really deal with? And that makes me anxious too, because as I said, I'm very close to her. So I kept calling her and texting her after, are you okay? Are you fine? You know, if somebody is disturbing at work, you know, make sure you speak out. Don't hold back. Or if you, and she's very smart, but I'm just worried that maybe she won't be able to express herself as much as she should in the adult work environment.
So it sounds, Lee, like you grew up in a very nurturing home where you felt safe and secure. And that enabled your sister to fly in terms of her academics, and other aspects of her, first round of education. And now venturing into the workspace, she's moving into a new space. And so it is about finding out who has your back, who is the support system. And navigating this new family called work, the world of work. And who are the people that will support you and encourage you versus the situation of 20 years of growing up in a family who she knew had her back and was nurturing her in all her uniqueness. And so it's not uncommon, for somebody to move into a new space, and feel a little overwhelmed and feel like they're not sure if they're on solid ground or shifting sand. But if she looks up and around to the people that she, that she's in community with in the workplace and finds one or two people that she can feel safe with, she will begin to feel the solid ground below her. And I'm sure once she's found one or two people that she knows she can rely on in this new workspace, she'll begin to flourish and find her way to express herself again.
I want to come back to that story, but I want to take one or two calls first, because I've got a question for you. I'm going to give you the talk show host responsibility. Remind me, I want to ask you about resilience.
Okay.
Jonathan, welcome to the show. Thank you for calling in today.
Good day, Eusebius and your guest.
Thank you.
I want to ask, I have a 14-month-old son, and I would typically say he's too attached to me than his mom. But I was listening when you were saying when the baby cries, this is some sort of language that they're saying they need this, they feel this, or could be this. So there are points where he He just cries, like walking around the house, crying for this. And then I drop everything and say, what do you want? And start talking to him. And he doesn't stand with me or be around me. He will grab a remote and go the other side or go grab something else, go the other way. And he's still doing those miming cryings. What could those be? And what am I supposed to do at that point? Because even if I drop everything that I'm doing and attend him, he doesn't seem to calm down. Up until probably I say, maybe you want to sleep. And then at some point I take him and put him on my back.
Okay.
And he sleeps later.
So, Jonathan, I want to firstly acknowledge you for the nurturing dad that you are, and for the fact that you're really wanting to connect with your son when he cries like that. Often, if
and not reaching for a bottle of Panado syrup in the first instance.
Absolutely. So the question is, are you able to see what your child was doing just before he started crying? Because this is a trigger and a response situation. So either he's dropped something that he can't get, or he has suddenly woken up to the reality that he's hungry or thirsty or something physiologically that's disturbing his inner system that's saying, help. Possibly the connection to the TV remote could be the how much do you connect to the TV remote? In other words, I'm wanting the toy that daddy usually uses because that's a good way to get his attention. So the first thing I would suggest you do, if your son will allow you to pick him up in that moment, take him up so you're close. Because you're immediately, when you take him into your arms, you're saying, I've got you, my boy. I've got you. I'm containing you. Whatever it is that's disturbing you, we'll work it out, but I've got you. Mm. And there's a measure of comfort and safety in that.
Mm, I can feel it. I want you to pick me up now.
Well, when I do that, when I do pick him up, actually, now he points the door. Now we must go take a walk out.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. You see, because he's in this pre-verbal phase. So it is a guessing game for the parent, and it can be hugely frustrating. Mm. But if you can rather take it more lightheartedly and say, okay, let's go and find out what you want or what you need. But if you specifically try to work out what, you know, it may not be in your exact view, but try to trace back. What was he doing just before he started crying for your attention? But the fact that you respond as soon as he's crying is the thing that will limit the anxiety. And then as you join in the search together to try and solve what it is he's wanting from you, the connection is there. And so we contain. As soon as we begin to contain, the child feels safe. And the answer can be found.
And you case the environment once you've picked him up. 18 minutes before noon. Susan, we're coming straight back to your call. Anyone else? I love Jonathan's sharing there. Dad, as well, if you call in, how do you deal with this kind of situation? How have you responded to actual or perceived anxiety in your little ones? 011-883-0702 in Joburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567.
And Cape Talk. Family matters.
So, I would imagine sometimes your own anxiety at your child crying is what you want to stop. And sometimes it's truly about wanting whatever is the reason your baby or toddler is anxious to be dealt with. But it's very important, I would imagine, as a carer, caregiver, as a mom, as a dad, as a teacher, whatever, to be able to also know what your motives are, right?
Absolutely. So we need to be very clear about when we're responding to the infant cry, we're responding to comfort the child. If we're getting hooked by the, I'm getting stressed because my baby's crying, then there's an enmeshment there. Yes, it's stressful hearing a baby cry, and particularly if we can't find solve the reason why the baby is crying and they don't settle down. But we need to be focused on, this is a message that baby's trying to send to me. rather than it's the baby is not sending a message of you're a bad mother, you don't listen, you're useless. That's not the message. The baby is purely saying, I'm hungry, I'm alone, it's an expression of their way of within their limitations of being able to say help.
So my resilience question is partly tied to this, and I do not want to be misunderstood. If a child has a problem that needs a parent to solve, that must happen as a matter of good parenting. But I wonder whether the story that an earlier caller shared about her sister struggling in a workspace environment, for example, and in part because mom was a helicopter mom was always present, is there the danger that if you don't read properly whether you are responding excessively to what you think is anxiety, but it's really your need to not hear your child crying, for example, that you could make them potentially less resilient once mom is not around to step in?
So it's the progressive pathway of parenting. So I'm a firm believer that you can't spoil a child in the first year of life. I don't believe it's possible because we are literally the caregivers of our infant who cannot do things for themselves. And if you think of the developmental stages, parent our infants through that first year, we're nurturing physically, mentally, emotionally. We're encouraging them to sit. We're encouraging them to roll over. We're encouraging them to crawl and to walk. Mm. And then what do? We are so behind them 100% when they stand up and they do the wobble and then they get the first step and the second step and and then they're running. And then guess what? They can get into things. And so suddenly they are able to start doing things for themselves. And so that very act that we have been encouraging them to do, because we know that this is the evolutionary process of development, as soon as they've mastered that, we start telling them to stop doing that skill because we don't want them to get into this and get into that and break the china and so on. And so we start helicoptering. Mm-hmm. And so there's this fine art between creating safe spaces for children, infants, toddlers, young children to play and live where they have the full extent of their ability and capacity, where we can continue encouraging them to develop, think for themselves, do things for themselves, towards a full independent life. And as parents, they need to know that we've got their back, so that if they fall down, we'll encourage them again to get up, to try again when something didn't work out. But if we are so on top of them that we're doing things for them, then why does the child need to bother?
Absolutely. Susan, thank you so much for holding on. Welcome.
Hi, CBS, and hi to your guest. I can relate so much to this topic. My son was quite the crier as a baby. He cried for 7 months straight. We went to every type of doctor, every type of homeopath, to try and understand what the reason was. But now listening to this conversation, I'm actually reflecting back on my own anxiety as a mom and thinking that might have been a lot of the reason why he cried as much as he did. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an example, my husband was much more calm than I was. So every time he was with him, he didn't cry as much as he used to. And I was almost like a liar when I used to tell him how much he used to cry during the day when he wasn't around. And I'm actually now making that connection. The question I now have is, because he's almost three now, how do I get him to stop using crying as the communication method now? Because I think he's learned that, to your guest's point, that every time I cry, mom and dad are always there to try and figure out what's wrong, and they try and solve the problem.
Yes.
But now, how do we get him to start communicating what's the issue instead of crying about it? Because he's three, and he can talk. So that's the challenge we now.
Stunning question. Thank you for sharing that, Susan. Wonderful journey that you're on there with parenting. Speak directly to Susan. I want to add in an extra question there out of interest as Susan is telling her story, which is, is there from a developmental theory point of view, age when children must stop crying and speak now and tell us what they think?
Well, Well, remember, crying is a language. Okay, that's the first thing. So, Susan, thanks so much for your call. And it's a beautiful segue into getting beyond the infant stage into this preschool stage and developing not just the verbal language, but the emotional language. And so when your child is crying, to say, you can ask him, I see you're crying. What are you crying about? If he's not able to find the words right in that moment, but you're able to see what he's crying in response to. So, for example, it could be if there's a sibling or a friend that's playing and they've grabbed a toy, then I can see you're feeling really upset because Johnny took your toy. Is that right? And then he can nod or go, yes, mommy, whatever, you know, because you're giving him the emotional language to what has just happened. Mm. And it's empathy. And as soon as we offer empathy, he can breathe.
Yeah.
Because his heart is understood. His emotions have now got a language out there that everybody else understands. Mm. And then you can start a conversation. So what do you think we should do? Shall we take turns? Mm. Now Johnny can have a turn. And then you can have a turn and you bring Johnny in. Johnny, did you take the toy? Yes. Did you want the toy? Yes. So then we start a whole thing of please and thank yous. And certainly with little ones, we can even go as far as you can play with this toy while I count three, and you count three with your child. One, two, three. And then you pass it back until it diffuses the emotion. And then one or other of them will buzz off because they can't be bothered to wait for the count of three. But the point is, number one, when you go to the child who's upset, you're containing again, like we were talking to Jonathan about his toddler. Yeah. So as soon as you're down at your child's level and eye to eye contact, we'll immediately build the connection. Mm. When we build connection like that from the brain chemistry, we've got oxytocin flying around. And it ignites that. So immediately, mum and child bond is there, so he feels safe. And he's not overwhelmed with this emotion of, my friend took my toy.
Mm-hmm. Have you started interacting with your little one in the way that Stephanie is sketching?
So we've started recently, and it has like helped a little bit. But, you know, I think his primary language is still revert to cry first, throw a tantrum. And then when mom gets in, we have the conversation, it's better. But I want to get him to a point where that's not the first thing he chooses to react with, you know?
Yeah, yes.
So I guess over time we'll get there, but yeah.
Yeah. Now, the reason why I was inserting my peanut gallery question is that I know moms like to compare kids with other kids of the same age group. Mm. And I have a distant cousin of mine who was crying even in sub A, grade one, and his poor mom would have to almost beat him every single day. Not the right response. But now in adulthood, he is a well-adjusted adult who is a teacher himself. And I often think to myself, my cousin would have been the last person who fellow moms would have predicted would be the child that would socially eventually adjust and even become an adult, let alone one that is a teacher after seemingly crying his way into the school ground every single day. But his mom obviously had heightened anxiety because her 6-year-old was crying and the other kids were not crying.
I can relate to that mom story. So I guess I'll take what you're saying and we'll continue with, you know, trying to understand why he's crying and helping him through that. Mm. And maybe it's about just explicitly having the conversation with him that when you want something, don't cry. First ask mommy and then let's see how that goes.
Cheers, Susan. All the best and thank you for sharing. Jan, is it Jan or Jan?
It's Jan speaking.
Jan, welcome to the show. Our last caller for today. Go ahead.
I am an industrial psychologist, but I deal with I've dealt with children, and I call it the perpetuation of anxiety syndrome. And if you reduce the relationship between a parent and a child, even the toddler, there's a stimulus and a response. And if the response is bigger than the stimulus, the child needs, say, one bottle and give two bottles. What I find later is when children are confronted with a problem, they see the problem bigger an actual response. As if it's a learned, you know, acquired from the parents' training. Now, I haven't done the imperial studies, but I've dealt with about 15 or 20 kids, and going talking to the parents, I quite often find that the parents, oh, now you're scared, you're not going to fall, you do this. And the parents' reaction was bigger than the stimulus that elicited that. I'd like your guest's opinion on that. Thanks.
So what I'm hearing is that the response is bigger than meeting the need where the need is, and sometimes that can be also overwhelming. And it's interesting that you've picked that lens to look at both children and then how that can play out in the workspace. We could go off at another tangent, Eusebius. But I think the first thing is at least if the response from the parent was that they were offering at least what the child needed and more, it meant that the need was satiated.
Hmm. You are always good, Stephanie. I think today you were particularly good.
Thanks, Eusebius. It was lovely to be here. And thanks to the listeners participating.
Cheers.
Cheers.